Welcome to the Brown Riot podcast. Hey! This podcast is all about what it takes to be successful in advertising when you're from a different ethnic, cultural, or socio-economic background to the majority. I'm going to be talking to some awesome creative leaders, as well as a bunch of brilliant planners, MDs and CEOs, getting their viewpoints and experiences about getting in and achieving success in the industry. It's a podcast that celebrates the achievements of people from diverse backgrounds, unashamedly. Just think about all the books you've ever read about advertising, on people like David Ogilvy, Bill Birnbach, David Abbott, Sir John Hegarty. All great, all legends, all white blokes. Time to mix things up a bit, I reckon. Now, by the way, the name Brown Riot is based on a song by The Clash called White Riot. That song in turn was based on Joe Strummer seeing the black community in West London fighting for their rights against racism and injustice. Inspired by their protest at the Notting Hill Carnival in 76, Strummer wrote lyrics about wanting a riot of his own. So I guess this is me saying I want a riot of my own. Okay, perhaps not a full-scale riot, but at least an injection of passion, soul, colour and diversity into a pretty vanilla industry. And super importantly, not just because diversity happens to be the buzzword of the month, but because I truly believe it will lead us to better work. It has to be all about the work. And lastly, before we get into it, I want to say that my ambition is a podcast that everyone interested in the business of creativity will find value in. It's absolutely not supposed to be a niche project for a niche audience. That'd be a pointless dead end. These chats are filled with so much insight and inspiration around creativity, so please give them a listen, whether your skin is brown, black, yellow, pink, green, or any shade in between. Okay, now we've set the parameters, let's crack into a chat with our first brown rioter. This is an ECD from an Indian background who's created and led award-winning work in his native South Africa, New York, and here in Oz. I think the success of the man can be measured both in the body of outstanding work he's created, the sackful of awards he's picked up, and the inspiring collaborative cultures he's built in the agencies he's led. Perhaps the pinnacle of his career so far has been the plethora of lines he brought home from Cannes this year, including the coveted Grand Prix for Good for the absolutely brilliant Project Revoice, developed in partnership with Finch and Nakatomi. He is the ECD of BWM, the one and only Ash Naidu. Welcome, Ash.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So I'd just like to start, Ash, by hearing a bit about your family background.
So we are fourth generation South African Indian. So grew up in South Africa and basically in the good old apartheid days, you know, where it was a tricameral system where everybody was in their own little section. So I was in an all Indian school all my life.
Wow.
University was the first time I actually had friends of different color. So it was a real eye-opener. It was like the most amazing experience. So, it's weird because, you know, you talk to people about South Africa and at the time you didn't know any better. So you just thought that was the way life was. And it's really only when I got to university that I just sort of, this whole new world opened up and I was like, wow, you know, learned about different cultures and had mates who were from different cultural groups, race groups. When you're a 17-year-old guy, a kid growing up, and suddenly there's girls from all over the country, you know, all different, you know, cultural backgrounds. It's pretty amazing. So, yeah, it was an interesting childhood.
So that leads me on to my first question, which is around one of the reasons I actually wanted to start this podcast. And as a brown guy myself from a pretty modest background, when I started off in advertising in London, I looked around and everyone that was doing well was not really like me. I was a bit of an anomaly. Agencies were packed with posh white guys with double barrel surnames and I was the odd one out. Whereas in that school system that you talked about, everyone was the same. So how did you find it when you were starting out? Was it more mixed in South Africa?
Well, the weird thing about, you know, when I was growing up, I was very lucky in that at the age of 13, I knew I wanted to be in advertising. And I was one of the few Indian kids who knew what advertising was, because I remember watching ads on TV and just thinking, oh, I had my favorite ads. And then there were those that I thought, oh, that's shit, I could do better than that.
At 13.
And we had guidance counselors at school and they were supposed to give you advice on career paths and stuff like that. And so they were asking, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And typical sort of Indian communities, everybody's like, ah, doctor, you know, lawyer, accountant. And mine was advertising. And I remember him saying, no, there's no such thing because all these big brands do their own advertising. So Coca-Cola would do its own advertising. In hindsight, he was probably very sort of, you know, forward thinking because a lot of it is going in-house now. But at the time, he was talking absolute nonsense. And I said, no, there is actually a career like advertising where you can come up with ideas. And he didn't believe me. And
so how did you know that?
I went to this place called a library. I don't know if those exist anymore. Yeah, I remember just loving seeing ads on TV. And so I said, let me go find out what this is all about. And got into an encyclopedia and checked out advertising and then started finding out about advertising agencies in South Africa and the famous ones. And just pursued it. So I was really lucky because from a very early age, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And when I finished school, typical thing, you know, with Indian communities, good grades become a doctor. And everybody's like, why is he doing advertising? You know, there wasn't an awareness of what it was about or the career prospects, which is surprisingly what I find here in Australia. Is that there's a whole audience that just has no idea that this is even an option. Mm. You know, it's not even on their radar. So nothing's changed since when I was a kid in that respect, you know, in this context. But yeah, so it became this thing that I just wanted to pursue. And I went up to AAA School of Advertising at the time. And typical Indian parents said, why don't you get a degree to fall back on? So I'd studied journalism at Rhodes University for 3 years and then did a postgrad in advertising at the AAA School of Advertising. So that was my way into the industry. And so
what was your first sort of foot in the door? How did that come about?
So basically at the end of AAA, end of the year, we had internships. And I got an internship because I didn't have a car. And all the agencies were really far away. And there happened to be one that was close to me that I could walk to. So I chose that one. It was very creatively called the Agency for Advertising and Marketing. Very, very creative name. And it was this weird place where run by an Afrikaans man. We did a lot of like sort of agricultural advertising and, you know, sort of kind of old school South Africa trying to make it into new school, new world South Africa. So it was an interesting mix of stuff. And, you know, I remember writing brochures for hotels and for grain farming. And, you know, it was all those sort of really boring jobs, but it gave me a really good foundation.
And what was the makeup of the agency like in those days? Was it quite mixed then at that stage? Was there Afrikaans and Indians? And
so it was 97. And 94 is when, you know, Mandela basically and the ANC came into power. So the country had started changing. So new things were happening and black empowerment was coming to the fore, which was really great. You could see that companies were doing it so that they could get business, especially in the advertising industry. Like there were a lot of situations where people of color were brought in just to make the numbers and get the quotas. And, you know, and this is the bad thing about this industry and the good thing about the industry is that, you know, sometimes things are done for not quite the right reasons. And I'm sure we'll get onto that later. But it was an agency that was made up of largely a white majority, and there were pockets of, you know, sort of black and Indian folk sort of working in different departments. But for a long time, I was the only sort of Indian in the creative department. And it was interesting because for me, it was great because I was just learning about new cultures and new sort of new backgrounds, exposed to new people. And what I was bringing was something they hadn't seen before. So it was a nice sort of clashing of cultures in an interesting way. And that's where I sort of learned how creativity can fuel that sort of mixing of cultures in a really cool way.
That's interesting. I always I remember my one of my heroes, Dave Trott, always said to me that being different to everyone else is just such a benefit, such a bonus, because you've got something that they haven't got and you need to leverage that, you know, much as you can. One of the things I do think you sort of mentioned about quotas and people being brought in, you know, for token reasons and the wrong reasons and all of that. I hear you on that.
I do kind of feel, though, and I don't know, I'm sort of interested to hear your take on this, that that whole thing about if you can't see it, you can't be it. When you look around and if you can't see people that kind of like you in some way, whether that's looks or background or whatever it might be, it's kind of harder to visualize yourself being able to be successful. Do you agree with that?
For sure. And at the time, there was Leo Burnett was an agency that was close to us in the same neighborhood. And there was an Indian creative director there, Rajesh Ranchod. I remember so clearly. And he was one of the very few Indian creative directors or non-white creative directors at the time. And he was a bit of a role model for the rest of us because we thought, oh, he can make it, you know, we can make it in this business. And the quota thing, just to be clear, and it's like, I think there's a right way of doing it and a wrong way of doing it. And a lot of times in those days, it was being used just as a front. Like, I remember terrible stories where we'd come in to work after lunch one day and suddenly there were a whole lot of people sitting in the open plan office that we'd never seen before. And it was all people of color. And we would sort of ask, what's going on? I said, oh, no, there's a pitch going on. The client's coming in and it's a BE thing. And we're like, that is absolutely disgusting. But there were stories like that, you know. I remember being called into a pitch that I wasn't working on at all, but it was for Air Mauritius. And the very dodgy account guy at the time said, are you busy Friday morning? We're just having a little meeting, you know, maybe you can sit in. And I was like, well, I haven't had anything to do with work, you know. And my creative director found out about it and was so angry. But there were stories like that where it was being done the wrong way. And then there were examples where, you know, there were kids who were really passionate and hungry about it that were given the chance and actually prove themselves. And just, I think it depends on the people that are sort of putting it into place. And if it comes from a good place, it'll be done in the right way. So I think that's very important, who's actually managing it. It needs to be done responsibly.
Just listening to that, it does remind me, and sort of particularly you talking about the role model of the Indian creative director at the time, it does sort of remind me of a funny situation we had in Cannes this year when you and I were obviously both in Cannes this year. I was there with the host of Ash crew and host of Ash were doing pretty well with the Palau Pledge, and you were obviously there with the BWM team and the Finch guys and the Nakatomi guys and smashing it with Project Revoice. And over the course of the week on three separate occasions, three separate people came over to me and congratulated me for the Project Revoice wins. You know, so each time I was in that awkward sort of situation of having to say, yeah, that wasn't me. It's a case of mistaken identity. That's kind of the other.
Eventually you took the credit.
Yeah. I mean, I found that quite funny. And I think we coined the hashtag, sort of hashtag too many brown ECDs at the time. But, I think there was a serious point there too. I mean, there's not that many people, you know, whether it's Indian or my background's actually Bangladeshi, but different sort of from different backgrounds, whether cultural or ethnic, in Australia, at a sort of a senior creative level, to the point where people think we're all the same, we're both the same person. I mean, do you think there should be more? Can we get more? Can we mix things up?
I think there definitely needs to be more, and I think, you know, there was a really sort of funny set of circumstances, but you're right, there's an underlying reason for that confusion. And when you dig a little deeper, you kind of think, yeah, there's so few of us that we do get seen as, oh, they're all, you know, confused with each other. And it happened to me, I had a friend, Kush, in my very first agency that I mentioned, and people would always get Kush and Ash confused. And we were two Indian guys who couldn't look more different, you know. But I couldn't understand how you could, you know, make that mistake. And I mean, I don't think you and I look that similar either. I mean, you know, besides the fact that we're brown and gray now. But there must be an underlying reason for that. You know, the fact that we're so few means that we get confused. And I don't know what the correct answer is, but there definitely needs to be more representation in not just the creative industry, but the industry as a whole.
We're on the subject of Cannes. Let's just kind of put the colour thing aside for a bit and just talk about Project Revoice. I mean, that was obviously an amazing project. You said to me at the time it's one of the sort of the biggest and best things you've worked on, and it absolutely smashed it at Cannes.
ALS is a tough disease. it's not very well known. Creating awareness and being an advocate is what I wanted to do.
I don't want to sound like a computer. I want to sound like me.
So to give Pat his voice back, we actually partnered with a tech firm called Lyrebird, who specializes in recreating the human voice from only 2 to 3 hours of audio samples.
Guess who's back, bitches?
We're so happy and grateful that Pat's going to be able to use his voice again to continue to speak for the ALS community and rally support for the cause.
It's changed my life forever.
How did it come about? Can you tell us the background to it?
I guess we always sort of try to be on top of the latest tech, and the guys were looking at voice tech at the time, and voice tech was everywhere, like Google Home and Alexa and Siri. But there was nothing really, it was all for commercial purposes, nothing being done for good. And one of the guys had an idea, or the team had an idea, that what if you used voice technology to actually help give back a voice to somebody who had lost it? And we all thought, that's amazing. But it's one of those ideas where you think, that's awesome. And like, how the hell do you do that? You know? And fortunately, the team involved are, they're the nicest guy, but they're also, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but they're like the nerdiest guys in terms of technology. So Google had this thing called Wavelength, which they had been studying and saying, oh, Wavelength can do this for Google Assistant. So maybe there's a way to change that, to do this, this and that. And a lot of the stuff, they when they first presented it to me, like I understood probably about 25% of it. I could get the human story out of it. The tech part just blew my mind. And then we went about trying to figure out how to do it. So we spoke to the likes of Google and Adobe and, you know, and everybody loved the idea, but it came down to resources and there's no money to investigate it further. And so we knew we wanted to do something with voice, and ALS was, because of the Ice Bucket Challenge, was the first thought that came to mind. And we investigated that Pat had lost his voice. So we got hold of ALS. They loved it, which was a great start. So the client was on board from the very beginning. And then we started looking around for a company, and Lyrebird was one of these tech companies that just popped out of nowhere, and they were just sort of leading the charge for voice tech. So the good thing was that they were very conscious of the fact that voice tech like this can be used in a bad way, and they wanted to make sure that it was used for good. So they were really on board with the social purpose part of it. I think that's what drew them to it.
We talk about advertising and we talk about Cannes and the cynical, hard-hearted, seen it all before advertising people. But I remember that night when you guys won that Grand Prix, there was a standing ovation that went on for kind of 2 minutes or more. The whole auditorium stood up and went bananas. It was quite a special moment, wasn't it?
That was emotional for us. We were talking about it afterwards. Everybody on stage, we were chatting up. We were like on the verge of tears because as we were walking down, we sort of saw people stand up. But then we got onto stage, got the award and turned around just to this entire auditorium on their feet. It's quite overwhelming. I've never experienced anything like that in my life before. You know, it was just all this sort of love and emotion just coming towards you and hitting you in the face. It was it was pretty special. Yeah.
All right. So I feel like that's brought us up to date in terms of your career. But if we were to dig back a little bit, take us to another highlight of your career.
I definitely would say NRMA car creation. Is one of those ones that I always put up there with one of my favorite pieces for many reasons. I think that was my first sort of CD job at TBWA, so it was quite special in that regard. But the team who came up with the idea, Craig and Tammy, were at the time, Craig is now ECD at RGA, you know.
He's doing all right.
He's doing all right. And you can tell why. I mean, they're just, you know, before we started that brief, I sort of, you know, you do those things where you send around like inspirational email trying to get people, you know, we could do something with this, it could be amazing and stuff like that. After we'd sort of done the whole project, we were talking about how it started off, and it was amazing because it was such a good brief. I think the prop on that brief was so single-minded. It's very rare that you get a prop that's so, you know, that you talk about USPs, and this was we ensure the parts of your car that others don't. We automatically cover the parts others don't. And our strategy team at the time did so much digging with the client to get to that single-minded prop. Because you never get single-minded props. You never get USPs like that in advertising.
Anymore. Only in award school.
So like half the thing sort of belongs to strategy for finding that, for really, you know, getting involved with the client. Because the client, you know, had a lot of information, but they had to find that gem. And Craig and Tammy sort of just explored it from every... Some of the ideas we had were so weird. Some crazy ideas, but... When they landed on this one, it was just so right for the product.
It's amazing how many car parts other insurers may consider extras and don't automatically cover. Your metallic paint, air conditioning, or even your floor mats may not be covered. If you don't have NRMA comprehensive car insurance, parts of your car may not be automatically covered.
It all worked together, and it was one of those projects that took so long to get fully sold because it kept dying at points. And going away for reasons of budget and whatnot. And so I'm proud of the whole team managed to keep it alive, first of all. And then when we got to making it, there were so many obstacles in the way, but we had to keep reminding ourselves, we're building a car, we're making something, you know, because it's not like you're just doing a TV ad or, you know, it's not like your traditional stuff. It was actually creating something tangible, which was so awesome. And I think just that visual of this weird-looking car was such a great sort of summation of everything the brief brought to light and in one sort of tangible thing. It was like the key visual, if you will, of the whole idea. But it was something you could actually get into and interact. So, yeah, that would be my favorite.
You just touched on something there that I'm really interested in personally, the making the leap from creative to creative director. So that was at TBWA, was your first creative director job. How did that, how did you find that? How did you sort of bridge that gap?
I think I was, I'd been creative director at, to an extent at the Palace and in a couple of other agencies, but I don't think it was really on the kind of accounts that I wanted to be on. Like NRMA was the biggest account at TBWA at the time. And I've always wanted to, I love doing sort of big work for big brands. And so it was the first time I felt like I was, this was a real meaty creative director job. I kind of thought earlier in my career that when you move to creative director, will I feel the need to write things myself? Or, you know, like, oh, if the work's not good enough, I'll do it myself. Or, and it's weird because it felt so comfortable. And it's probably because I had really good creatives, you know, working with me. But it just felt like I wasn't trying to prove that I've got the smartest idea or, you know, this is the best way to do it. But I felt like this nurturing sort of thing came over me. I was like, I wanted them to shine. And it was easy because they were so talented. But it really felt like a natural sort of next step. I enjoyed not doing the ideas myself, but helping guide the idea, you know, and helping bring it to life. So in a weird way, it sort of gave me as much satisfaction as coming up with ideas myself, you know. I still love doing my sort of own things, you know, because I think that's where you become a creative. You want to come up with ideas. But the creative director thing just felt like I don't know how to describe it. It just felt like a natural fit.
You just reminded me of Kenny Dalglish, the Liverpool football player. There was a time when Kenny Dalglish went from being the best player at Liverpool to being player manager, and he was managing the team and still playing in the team. And someone asked him after on Match of the Day, I think, Kenny, how do you know, like, have you got the right balance in the team and how are you going? And Kenny Dalglish said, I'll know I've got the right team when I can't get in it.
Exactly.
Kind of, I've always loved the idea of him putting himself outside of that team.
Yeah, Dave Bowman, who was my ECD at TBWA, said, he said, always hire people that are smarter than you. You know, and it was like, and that's the truth. I want all my creatives to be smarter than me. Like I shouldn't, like the Dalglish thing, you shouldn't be able to get a place in the team, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think it's, that's more satisfying in a way, you know, it's because it's a different job. It's a completely different job. And I didn't realize how different a job it was until I became a creative director, you know? And it doesn't mean that if you're a good creative, you'll necessarily be a good creative director. I think a lot of people struggle with that. You know, I know some brilliant creatives and they're so stuck in their ways that prevents them from being brilliant creative directors. So I think there's a level of being able to let others take the glory You know, that's a very important part of it. And if you can't do that, you're going to struggle.
I think I see myself in the same mold. I see it as a kind of the Gareth Southgate mold, to talk to the football analogies a bit more. I think the ironic thing is when you do that and when you kind of hand over the reins a bit, they end up making you look great, you know.
Exactly,
it's not,
yeah.
You know, it's not all completely selfless.
No, exactly.
Kind of, you know, yeah. You hire great people and they make you look good, so everyone wins.
I remember there were a couple of creative directors that I've had in my career. And I think that's the other thing. I waited. I didn't want to jump into the role.
Oh, okay, that's interesting.
Into the ECD role, actually. I didn't want to jump into the ECD role too early because when I was leaving South Africa at the age of 30, I was offered an ECD role at Lowe at the time. And I just didn't feel I was ready. I was like, I'm not ready for this. I also want to still keep thinking myself and develop my ideas and all that stuff. And so I waited. And the benefit of waiting was that I had so many ECDs to compare in my career to decide what type of ECD I wanted to be, you know, and there were good and bad from each one. Some were just terrible. But then there were some that I was like, yeah, it's like in school when, you know, you've got a teacher you really like and you want to do well. So you make them happy, you know? So I wanted to be that kind of
ECD. You sort of learn from the terrible ones as well.
You learn what not to do. And I remember, because you were asking about the credit thing, there were some ECDs who felt they had to change an idea in order to say, oh, I did that, so I had a part in it. And I was like, for me, I'm happiest when I can just get out of the way. Mm-hmm. You know, I want it to be great so that I don't have to do anything and you know, and just send that through. That would be the ideal situation, you know. Because like you say, your name's on it anyway, so I don't know why people get so worried about it, like, oh, I need to change this or do this to make my mark on it. I think it's bullshit.
So sticking with the work, because we're drilling into the work now, we've talked about some of the pieces from your career. What about outside of stuff that you've done and you've worked on? What's the stuff that you see out there today that really excites you or inspires you?
Well, I guess because we've just come back from Cannes and, you know, Burger King's hackvertising stuff was really interesting. I mean, the chief marketing officer, Fernando Mercado, who went to Burger King and turned it around, is my ex-client from BBH New York days when we worked at Vaseline. And we've kept in touch and, you know, been good friends. But he basically did Sea of Skin, which was a great thing for Vaseline and BBH New York. Then he went to Dove and he did Dove Sketches. And after Dove, he came over to Burger King. And he's one of those creative clients. You know, he's a creative first, I think, before he's a client. And he sees the value in making a brand talkworthy. Like, you know, and with hackvertising and that whole, you know, presentation they did, it just showed you how they were inserting the brand in a way into the cultural zeitgeist where people would just naturally talk about it. You know, they were on topics that were just people cared about. So it wasn't like they're forcing Burger King on people, but they're making Burger King part of the conversation in a very natural way because they're talking about issues that people actually care about. And that's what they're really good at. So I love the work that's coming out of Burger King. As a network, I think Wyden and Kennedy is still my favorite. I just love the way they look at problems so differently and find such creative ways to solve them. That's the kind of work that I'm liking at the moment.
I mean, what about trends? Because we've talked a bit about Cannes and, you know, you come back from Cannes and people say, oh, what are the trends? What's going to be big this year? And I kind of ended up thinking that there's so many trends. It's almost sort of pointless chasing them. You mentioned tech as well. With tech and creativity, it's almost as though anything is possible, which is super exciting and kind of slightly scary.
I tend to agree with you. I think it's pointless chasing trends because that's what they are. They're just trends. And you can try to follow them, but next year there's going to be something new and you're going to be behind. You'll always be chasing it. And sounds cliched, but you'd rather set the trends than follow them. But with the technology thing, I think I'm very against tech for tech's sake. And I hate when I see ideas where it's like, oh, let's use VR for this. Or when clients come to you and say, we really want to do something with, you know, augmented reality, or we want to get this and this. And you're like, but why? How does it make sense for your brand? And I think tech is only good if there's a reason for it and if it's, affecting people in an emotional way or and I don't mean emotional in terms of just revoice making you cry, but if it's just having some impact in their lives. So I think with any of these trends, it's got to have something that resonates with people. At the end of the day, I was talking to somebody on the weekend who was saying, they were saying, how do you keep in touch with, what's new and all these different channels coming up? And I said, yeah, they are platforms on which to communicate. But at the end of the day, as long as you're still talking to people, people are going to relate to emotion, and you've got to find a way to get to the core of, what they care about. So that'll never change. So it's just finding ways of using all these different trends, channels, media to get to them in an emotional way.
You just talked about the Burger King client, and he just sounds like an awesome dude. He's done some, he's done some amazing things, and I think it feels to me like he's kind of willing to take risks, and it feels like all of that great work does take a bit of risk. And I sometimes feel in Australia the clients don't take enough risks, or they feel a bit more risk averse, I think is the way I should put it. And I think because of that, the work becomes a bit more vanilla, the industry becomes a bit more vanilla. And I wonder if I kind of link it back to what we were talking about at the start. The industry becomes a bit more vanilla because there's not the diversity, there's not the different socioeconomic groups, the gender diversity, the age diversity, all of those things. Now, you and I have talked in the past about setting up some kind of course for young people to get a leg up into the industry from different backgrounds, from those different cultural backgrounds or ethnic backgrounds or socioeconomic backgrounds, people that don't even know that this industry is an opportunity, is a potential thing that they could do. That's something you feel quite passionate about, isn't it?
Yeah, I think because I think there's so many stories that aren't being told or reflected in Australia. I know certainly that's the way it was in South Africa a while ago, because it was just the stories of one sort of group of people that were, and in that case, it was the smallest group being publicized. And in South Africa, it's come a long way, because I think there's real integration happening. And you just look at the media landscape and the advertising industry and the types of ads that come through and the types of humor that, you may not be used to, but you learn so much when you watch TV. It's like an education in its own in terms of the culture and the country you live in. When I went back home a couple of years ago, I was just watching TV and I was amazed by how, just little slangs and catchphrases from the township were now everybody was using. And it was, and advertising has this power to sort of spread the word and spread this mixing of cultures. We have such a great platform to do it. I don't see that happening here. I see a style of advertising and a style of storytelling that's very similar, and I think it'll just be more interesting, I think it'll be more reflective of the true country that we live in, but it'll just make things more interesting, really. There's just so many more interesting stories to tell, and it'll make people feel more included, they're represented in this country. You can see, after the yes vote, suddenly in advertising, you started seeing same-sex couples, You started seeing, and recently you started seeing mixed-race couples in, some of the ads. What I don't like is when it's done very tokenistically, and you can tell those that do it, and you can tell those that do it naturally. But at least there's a movement being made to tell different stories. But I think it's one thing putting people of color in ads, but it's a completely different thing telling stories that are relevant to those communities and experiences that those communities have. So instead of just having the same storytelling format and inserting brown people and black people here and there, we need to go further into dig into what the issues are, faced by people of different colors in this country, or what the experience they have on a day-to-day basis, because it's not the same for everyone.
That's brilliant, mate. That's absolutely brilliant. That's opened some doors in my mind for me, because I've been in a lot of conversations over the last couple of years where we've been talking about things like we need to get more people of colour or more minorities or whatever kind of minority is into ads. We do an analysis of all the ads we've done over the last 20 years, and we're going to add up how many lesbians we had or how many brown people or whatever it may be, and there's only 7% and we need to get it to 9% and all of those kind of things. And maybe that's important, getting those numbers up and having more different kinds of people in the work. But I think you're right. It's not about just swapping out one kind of person for another. It's about telling a broader range of stories. It's just more richer and more interesting, more reflective of the country, I suppose.
Yeah, because I think the experiences you have living in North Shore or even eastern suburbs will be very different to the experiences you have living elsewhere in the country, you know? Mm. And it could be, you know, similar topics, but different experiences of similar topics. So it'll be interesting to see those stories come to light. I don't feel like I completely know Australia, you know, because I've lived like 9 years in Sydney, you know, and all I've watched is national TV, which just shows me Sydney. I've heard, though, that regional TV is amazing because some of the advertising is really crazy. It may not be the best advertising, but I've heard some of the ads out in regional Australia are like completely different. I think that's good, you know. I'd love that those sort of stories to be told by everyone nationally. And
I mean, going back to the people's pathways in, young kids' pathways into the industry, you talked about how your family kind of looked at you like you're a crazy man because you wanted to do advertising. Why do you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or whatever it may be? I feel the same. There must be the same conversations would go on in, you know, the homes of Lebanese kids out west whose parents want them to be working the family business, or Vietnamese kids out in Cabramatta or whatever it may be. And as we've talked about before, some of these kids don't even know that it's a viable option. You know, and the idea of just all that brain power, all those different rich stories going to waste that could be coming into the industry, it feels like a really good thing to somehow make that happen.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's a tragedy that it's not even on the radar as a career choice, that people don't even know that you can do it. Or that parents in certain communities just feel like, yeah, well, that's no future for you. There's no money in that. Or, you know, get a real job, you know. And I think it's only with education, and maybe, you know, we were talking about going to schools and telling them what we do, you know, what being in advertising involves, getting them excited about it. Because it's still, when you think about it, if you can have an idea and see that idea come to life in the real world and have everybody else in the world watch that, that's still the most amazing thing, you know? Like, none of my mates who are accountants or dentists can say that stuff they do gets seen by the world and, you know, people laugh or cry, or it's an amazing career that we're in. And, you know, it'd be lovely to open that up to more people.
I imagine sort of going to schools and showing them things like Project Revoice and then, you know, kids saying, wow, I didn't realise you could do stuff like that in advertising. But equally, I imagine sort of putting up on a big screen Nike Nothing Beats a Londoner and having kids kind of go, wow, that's just so cool, you know. And we've talked about some kind of course as well, some kind of way of creating specific pathways for different kinds of kids to come into the industry. I mean, I've chatted to various people about that idea, and there's a lot of love for it. There's, I think, one way or another, we need to make that happen. But I have had some people say to me, well, that seems like positive discrimination. That feels like, you know, you're excluding certain people and you're only having, you know, certain other people in. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I don't think it has to be done at the expense of others, because I think all we're doing is handing out an opportunity to somebody or making someone aware of a career path that they weren't aware of otherwise. I don't think it's taking away from anybody else's ability to get into advertising. There was a similar question that came up, you know, in South Africa when things were changing and with BEE, and people were saying, oh, but just because of the color of their skin, they're getting the job, or, you know, and I'm not. And I think it is a tough point, obviously, but where we want to be, this is probably a better way of putting it, where we want to be eventually is where we shouldn't even be discussing the color of someone's skin or somebody's gender. It should be a non-issue. We should be doing work and people getting jobs just based on their merit, where there's a level playing field. Unfortunately, at the moment, there isn't. So work needs to be done to level it out so that we do get to that point where it is not an issue and it's not even a talking point. So we definitely want to be at the point where we're not discriminating based on your color or your gender, but that's the ideal. We need to work now so that we get to that point where it doesn't become an issue.
That makes absolute sense. That, for me, is exactly why we're sitting here doing this podcast. Yes, it's a podcast that's called Brown Riot, that celebrates brown people and yellow people and, you know, all kinds of other shades of different colours and different kinds of people that are doing amazing things. And I sort of 100% want it to be inspirational, not some kind of positive discrimination thing. That kind of, that term just kind of horrifies me.
Yeah.
I just want it to be a celebration. And when you say, I suppose if we keep celebrating people enough to the point where you don't need to do things like this, where there is a level playing field.
Yeah. And I mean, that's exactly what we want. We want it to not be an issue, but at the moment it is an issue. So we have to address it so that we get to a point where it's not an issue. Like I gain a lot of hope and positivity from, I guess, coming from South Africa and seeing the industry change and my mates in the industry back there who are doing so well now, you know, and a lot of my mates, like people of color there who are like creative directors and ECDs and who are just doing some of the freshest, most amazing work. And the stories they're telling are not the stories I was hearing 20 years ago. Mm. The stories are completely different.
You know? In what way?
Like back in the day when I started off, it was very much South Africa drew from New York, London, you know, America, London sort of thing. Style of advertising, the structure of work was very much in that way, you know, like, oh, you had a certain, it was a clever ad or it was an ad and you had a pithy line at the end. And, you know, there was a construct that you learned to follow. What's happened in the last 20 years is that I'm seeing stuff where it almost feels like it's not advertising. It's kind of just dipping into culture. And some of the best work is just really fun, sort of like moments spent with people in different parts of the country, you know? So the stories would never, and this is the thing, they would never, if you put it into awards context, they'll probably never win awards in the global award shows because people wouldn't understand the nuances of it. But I don't care about that because for the people living in that country, they all felt like, oh, we're represented, we're on the screen, that's us, you know? And that's cool, you know? It feels like all the stories are being represented equally and even people who don't come from those backgrounds are learning something as well. And it's becoming part of the culture of this united country. And that's what we can do here, you know? I look at, there's an idea called the immunity charm that came from Afghanistan or something. And it was a really brilliant idea and it's won lots of awards for its ingenuity and cleverness, but it's the simplest idea. And it was, I think in Afghanistan, what happened was that kids were not getting the vaccines that they needed. And it was hard for doctors to realize which vaccines had been given to kids. So there was this cultural thing, which was just a charm bracelet. And they used something that was so local and so traditional. And they started giving a different bead for each vaccine that was administered. So if you went to a different doctor, a different part of the country, they could see through the charm bracelet which vaccine you'd got. And, you know, it was such a clever, simple idea based in such a cultural truth of that place. But I sort of love work like that, which just sort of embraces the nuances of different countries and cultures and races. And you know, because it just feels different automatically. It's like it's not something that somebody in a different country would come up with easily. It doesn't follow any construct or it doesn't follow any formula. It just feels locally rich.
And I mean, just going back to what you were saying before about the work coming out of South Africa today, it's like you said, Ash, the advertising is like a reflection of the culture of the times of that country. It's a snapshot of a culture. So I think about the work that I see coming out of London. It does feel as though, you know, nothing beats a Londoner. The work that comes out of London in general feels like a really true reflection to me of the place, of the, you know, of the UK. I feel like maybe this is just looking on the Campaign Brief blog. I don't know. I've got kind of a true enough reflection of all the work that comes out of Australia. But it sometimes feels to me that all the work isn't a true enough reflection of the whole country.
Definitely. I completely agree with that. And it's weird that you mentioned nothing beats a Londoner because I've never lived in London and I don't know the nuances in that ad. But when I saw that, I just felt like that feels like it's so true to the youth of London because there were just moments in there where it just felt like, I didn't even get the joke. I didn't even get what they were talking about. I knew that there was something there that, you know, it just felt so, it was raw and it's like off the street, like that actually happens. They just filmed it, you know? So you were dipping into their culture. And yeah, and there isn't much of that here.
To me, I don't know if people even got this or not, because you could have just enjoyed that ad as just a spectacular sort of beautifully filmed ad about sport or whatever. But it was very similar to the immunity charm in a way, because you talked about ideas being rooted in a very sort of localized cultural truth. And someone said to me, oh, that ad could have been nothing beats a Sydney cider or nothing beats a, you know, it could be transferable. But there was a truth at the heart of that ad, which is that London's a bit of a nightmare for sport. You know, there's just not the space and the outdoor and the lovely weather and the stuff that we've got here. So it just kind of makes it really difficult. And, you know, when you want to do a sport that's not even a big sport, like ice hockey or rowing or whatever, it kind of is even, you know, you've got to struggle to do that thing. So I think that that truth, rooting it in that cultural truth, made it super powerful. So we've talked a bit about your career so far, the success at Cannes this year. I'm just kind of wondering where your head's at for the future. What's your plan in terms of work, the kind of work you want to be doing? You're in Australia for the long haul?
No, I'm definitely in Australia for a long while. My wife's Australian, my kids are Australian. So, but I do love the country. And, you know, as much as I say I don't know as much as I should, the things that I do know are awesome. But I did take one thing away from Cannes, and it influences the type of work that I want us to get back to doing. I know Project Revoice is charity, so this is rich for me to say, but I just saw a lot of charity work at Cannes. It was probably 80% charity, and there was a lot of stuff that felt like it was made for awards with no real visible or tangible benefit. And there was probably 20% where it was like sort of hard, big brands. You know, the Americans are really good at doing the big brand work, the great big brand work. That's what I'd love to sort of start getting back to. And that's why I mentioned NMA Car Creation, because it was like really big brand, tough category, but a very creative solution to a problem. So we're trying to find, you know, those opportunities with now big brands and trying to convince clients to take a leap, to, you know, take a risk. I want to get Fernando out and just speak to clients, you know, and just, he's been out for the advertising week. But yeah, it's just, I always believe you should do your best work on your biggest brands. And as many people as possible should see it. So, I mean, we still love doing sort of charity pieces, but it's charity pieces that you can see real, you know, impact in the real world, as opposed to just things that are sort of fleeting. But yeah, if there's anything I'm trying to do, it's trying to get the tough, sort of meaty clients to do really interesting work. We sort of had some success with Qantas. We had this thing called Passport Takeoff, which was a really interesting sort of solution to a business problem. And that's the sort of space I want to play in.
I mean, that's interesting, because I was sort of wondering as you were talking there, how you feel about that world that's a crossover of those two things. I saw a lot of things this year where brands, or over the last few years actually, where brands have tried to, for whatever reason, rightly or wrongly, you know, with the best intentions at heart, or maybe not, ulterior motives maybe, tried to reach for a higher purpose. P&G won the Grand Prix this year, won a film Grand Prix for The Talk, which is kind of based on their My Black is Beautiful platform.
Yeah.
Did that resonate for you, or did you sort of see that as being sort of slightly cynical? Or?
No, I think, you know, P&G's done quite a few things like that. I think if it feels intrinsic or right for the brand itself, then it's okay, you know. We always joke about the mission of, I think it was mission of Starbucks, saying saving the world one coffee at a time. And you kind of think there's got to be a logical connect between the brand and what they're doing, you know, because you know that in all these big organizations, there's a CSR component, which is saying we need to do some stuff to make it seem like we're good, but we can still do all these bad things here, but it's a nice facade, you know? Mm. And I think people, humans, are becoming more and more aware of that. So if it doesn't feel authentic, if it feels like it's just a sort of covering, you know, people will see through it. So I kind of like the the work where the brands do something that they have knowledge and expertise in and feels right for their brand, but they're doing good. So that's fine, you know. But when you find like a bank suddenly doing something for something that's completely unrelated and you just think, how is that connected? Or, you know, I kind of look for a link, a logical link.
It's funny you should say that about a bank, because some friends of mine, some good mates of mine, work on the Westpac stuff, and they've been doing some, I think, really interesting work over the last year or so. Some big, actually, probably some of the biggest ads in Australia in terms of production, you know, values and budgets and stuff, and some really beautiful work. And some of that is in the space of the things Westpac do that are not necessarily your day-to-day banking things, the kind of how they back you up when you're people are bereaved, or how their Westpac chopper goes and helps people. And I had a few chats with some other people who were like, well, what's that got to do, you know, with my mortgage and so on. I feel that for Westpac, the dots are very much joined. They're kind of, you know, they've done a lot of stuff off the back of their 200-year bicentenary, and that's a company that has for 200 years really kind of looked after people in this country, has always kind of put a bit of their time and effort and profits, I think, into helping communities. So I think that's, for me, giving them credibility to do that. To your point, I think it's when there's no credibility there or no heritage or history, and suddenly a brand comes in and starts talking about some random feel-good thing that you kind of think, hang on.
Like, for example, the last one, I thought there was such a beautifully crafted ad, the death one, you know. Lovely story, beautifully crafted. And we were talking about it the other day. We were like, when I read the article afterwards, it sort of dawned on me more. I think if they just had a little bit at the end about, you know, and look, in hindsight, the line says, when you lose someone, we're here to help, right? Makes sense. But I think people are not used to thinking of banks that way. So they needed something that said, because when they were reading the article and it said about how, you know, when someone dies, you have all these financial difficulties, you know, da, 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 and the bank can really help you out there. Makes perfect sense. It just felt like it needed something at the end to tide a little more, like a...
Do you mean like in a P&G world, the RTVs, the reasons to believe?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But I love the ad. I thought it was so beautifully crafted. And I think I still like it. I think, and it works for me even without the line, but I think it could be stronger. And I think that's why people were sort of questioning, what does a bank have to do with that? But when you do think about it, like if your loved one passes away, the last thing you want to think about is finances. And, you know, so, but I think a little bit of clever copywriting there, a little like a designator of what it does, which is hard to, like, it's hard to say bereavement finance because that sounds cold, you know, and calculating, but
bereavementfinance.com.
But I mean, it's sort of, I think it would have something to close a loop in people's minds to say, oh, well, yeah, actually that makes sense.
All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap up now. I suppose I just wanted to say thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having
my first guest. Thank you very much. Definitely loads of food for thought there. Yeah. Let's keep talking about how to move the industry forward in a positive way. Was there anything else that you wanted to add?
No, but I do think the point about, you know, I can see where people would see this in a negative way, but it's what I was saying earlier. We want to get to that point where it's not an issue what the color of your skin is or what your gender is, where it's just purely on merit, to that level playing field. But we need to do work now so that we can get there, because it's not a level now.
Okay, thanks again to Ash. Thank you to you for listening, and thank you to the guys at Smith & Wester for pulling this together. Dan and Nick here are absolute legends in sound. From creating original music tracks, stings and sound effects, to recording VOs, radio commercials and podcasts. They're master craftsmen, an absolute joy to work with, and genuine supporters of positive steps in the industry. So please keep them in mind for all your sound requirements. Thanks again. Until next time.